do not flatter yourself. Okay? I don't think it has anything to do with meditation. If I make you sit there quietly and not allow you to use your mobile phone or to read, you will also fall asleep. All right? So it has nothing to do with meditation hindrance. It's just the conditions of this time period. So if you do find yourself very sleepy, instead of struggling against it, I would suggest you just go along with it and see what happens. This is what I call the long road to sleep. Long road to sleep, which can be traversed in an instant for some people. Right? I just start and they're gone, okay? But if that didn't happen to you, you may get to experience a different how the mind and the body respond to sleepiness. Right? And you can actually learn how we can our awareness, the light of our awareness, can gradually go dimmer and dimmer, while you still remain kind of relatively aware that something is happening. And that is a very important skill to learn, because eventually when you move on deeper to your meditation practices, then you will encounter the true meditation hindrance, which is called laxity, or sometimes called lethargy, which is this losing the brightness of the mind as a part of your meditation. And that is actually a very difficult hindrance to recognize, because you are losing your awareness while it's happening. So this can be an opportunity to learn a little bit about this state of mind called sleepiness. Right? So don't struggle, just allow yourself to go. And if you do fall asleep, the benefit is later when Venerable is teaching, you will be fully awake. Isn't it wonderful? Yeah. Right. And we're going to meditate on self-compassion, right? Like what Venerable just mentioned. Yeah. It's an impromptu one. That's right. We will meditate on self-compassion in a practice called reverse tongling. Because just now, we breathe in the darkness and we breathe out the light. So sometimes it's also good to do the reverse. We let in something bright and radiant, right? Something light. Light both in terms of brightness and light also in terms of lightness. Because sometimes maybe the heart feels very heavy, the shoulders feel very burdened from the stress and the burden of daily living. So it's good as a way to change our experience, help ourselves. We let in something radiant, bright and light that symbolizes positive experiences out of compassion for ourselves, out of love for ourselves. Okay. So and usually we synchronize it with the breath. So when you breathe in, allow something bright to come in. You can visualize it if you are good at it. If you are not, then for me, it's just to let in a texture of experience that symbolizes something really positive, really uplifting, a sense of care and concern for yourself. Okay? And then the out-breath, you can also make use of it to release anything that is weighing you down or holding you back. And you can give it an image also, something dark, like dark smoke, like some exhaust, something that is felt toxic and dangerous. You can release it as you breathe out. Okay, and you can release it as a kind of texture of experience. Sometimes we feel very suffocated, you know? So you can release that feeling. Sometimes you feel very cold inside in your heart, then you can release that coldness. So you can change the images around. Breathe in something warm and breathe out something cold. Or the reverse also can. If you like coolness, you breathe in coolness and you release the kind of stuffiness in your heart. Okay? So symbolizing something, take in something positive, offer something positive to yourself and release yourself from something negative. Now the important thing with this release is you're not blowing it out. Right? You're not trying to blow it out. Blowing out is a sense of trying to get rid of it. Right? There is deep in it, there is a sense of aversion to what is going on within your experience. And we don't want to cultivate aversion. Right? So that's why I use the word release. It's a very gentle gentle action. Of just as the breath goes out and release the carbon dioxide, you can also release anything that is weighing you down, holding you back, sort of suffering, that is things that keep you in a suffering state. You can release it, okay? And then see what happens. All right, so I'll guide you. I usually present it in a three-step process. So first step is to do with the posture. Second step is I invite you to return your attention to here and now, to your own body, just to help you transition into meditation. And the third step will be this meditation on self-compassion. All right? So if you're okay, so let's start. So first step, I call it acquiring a seat. So take a few moments, find a supportive posture for your body. You're sitting on the floor. Then try to have one that allows your body to be supported on as broad a base, broad and stable base as possible. And if you are sitting on a chair, good to have both feet firmly planted on the ground. And most important part of the posture is your spine, your back. See if you can allow it to be upright in a natural way. Don't need to try too hard to straighten it, because eventually you will release that kind of tension. Just allow it to be upright and allow yourself to be able to breathe freely and easily. And you can rest your hands and arms in whichever way is most comfortable for you. You can rest them in your lap, or place them on your knees, whichever way that allows your shoulders to feel relaxed. You're most welcome to leave your eyes slightly open if that's helpful, or I usually close my eyes. So whichever way works best for you. So take a few moments, allow your body to find its way into your posture. And usually I invite people to place your attention, your awareness first at the points of contact between your body and your seat, your cushion, your body and the ground. See if you can notice at those points of contact sensations beneath you. Sensations of something solid, firm. Maybe a sense of hardness, or could also be a sense of softness. Qualities we associate with the ground, with the earth, they are here to support your body, to hold you up. See if you can allow your body to get a real good sense that it is well supported in this posture. There is a sense of balance, and also a sense of safety in this posture. And give permission for your body in its own time to unwind, to loosen up, to release unnecessary tightness or tension so that it can comfortably settle down into your meditation posture. So that's the first step, acquiring a seat for your body and your mind in meditation. And the second step, we're going to take some time to help body and mind to make a transition. See if they can fully settle down into the meditation. So for that, we're going to make use of our natural breath. So see if you can become aware of sensations in your body that are associated with the breath. Some of you may notice the breath around your nostrils, subtle sensations of air flowing in and out. Or you may notice movements at your chest, a sense of expansion and contraction with each breath. And sometimes some of us may even notice the movement at the abdomen, movement of rising and falling, synchronized with the breath. So see if you can let into your awareness some of these sensations of the breath. You can feel free to focus on a particular spot if you like, or just allow yourself to experience the entire wave of sensations moving through your body as you breathe in and as you breathe out. So coming back to the breath, as you become aware of sensations of the breath, you will notice that your attention doesn't stay with it. Attention tends to drift off to sounds in the surrounding, maybe thoughts of the past, memories, maybe thoughts of the future, some fantasy or daydreams. So all these are perfectly normal activities of your mind. Our mind tends to wander, our attention tends to move. And that is not a problem by itself. Every time I say something, every time you become aware that your attention is elsewhere, you can always choose to come back. Come back to your breath, come back to your body, come back to here and now, and just continue with your meditation. So coming back to your breath sensations, see if you can start by paying closer attention to your out-breath. Feel the out-breath. Notice the sensations of relaxation that goes along with it. When the muscles of your diaphragm, muscles of your chest relax. Breathing out is a movement of release. We release the carbon dioxide, the still air in our lungs. See if you can tune into the sense of release or relaxation with each out-breath. Breathing out is an opportunity to release. So just as you release the carbon dioxide, maybe some of the tightness, tension or discomfort in your body may also flow away with the breath. And a good place to start is actually with your face. So often we unconsciously tense up our facial muscles, tighten the muscles of the forehead, or we tense up muscles around the eyes or those at the jaw. So as you breathe out now, see if you can release some of those tensions in your face. Let in a feeling of softness into your face so that your whole face feels a little bit more relaxed, a bit more comfortable with each breath. Coming back to your breath, especially your out-breath, just as you can soften the muscles of your face, see if you can allow or give permission for a similar sense of softening, loosening to happen in other parts of your body. Don't need to try too hard to make it happen. Simply allow it to happen in its own time. Muscles in the body that are unnecessarily tight or tense might just loosen up in their own time. Coming back to your breath, likewise you can also release thoughts that pop into your mind, images, words, commentary, things that preoccupy your mind, your attention, drawing your attention away from the breath, from the present moment. As you breathe out, you can also release all these thoughts, all these images. Just allow them to flow away so that you can gently return your full attention back to the breath, back to your body, back to this present moment. Now to begin the step three, the actual meditation on self-compassion. Breathing out, as you release all that is unwanted, unnecessary, see if we can give them a form, a visual one, such as imagining you're breathing out dark, exhaust, something toxic, something harmful. Just imagine seeing them leaving your body, leaving your system, and disappear completely. Out of compassion for yourself, release all things that are holding you back, keeping you down, keeping you in a state of unhappiness, or suffering, or stress. Breath by breath, as you breathe out, release. And you can even mentally say the word release, reminding yourself this is something you can do. Release that which is unwanted, unneeded, unhelpful from your own system. Coming back to your breath gently, without feeling upset if you do get distracted or caught up in thinking about past or future. When you become aware of it, when you choose to come back, and as you breathe out, release that dark smoke, release that darkness, or whatever it is that is unhelpful, out of compassion for yourself. May I be free from the suffering and the causes of suffering. Coming back to your natural breath. Now see if you can shift your attention and notice your in-breath. Breathing in, you take in oxygen flowing into your lungs, into your blood, pumped by your heart, to all the organs, to every cell in your body, especially the neurons in your brain, giving them energy, allow them to function, to grow, to repair, giving you a sense of alertness, brightness of mind. And you can visualize as you breathe in that oxygen, breathe in that fresh air, you breathe in something radiant, something bright. Breathe in textures of experience that symbolizes that which is positive, uplifting, healing, sense of warmth, if that's helpful, a sense of coolness, maybe a sense of spaciousness or lightness. Breathe that in, breath by breath, with your in-breath. Let that positive attribute flow into your chest, filling up your lungs, touching your heart, and from there, spread through all parts of your body, all corners of your mind. Coming back to your breath, breathe in, let in something bright, radiant, something light or warm. See if you can do so with a quality of loving kindness towards oneself. May I find happiness and the causes of happiness. And then at your own pace, in your own way, feel free to alternate the two movements. Sometimes focus on releasing on the out-breath. Sometimes focus on taking in on the in-breath. At your own pace, in your own way. I'm going to keep quiet and allow you to meditate in silence. Okay, so that's it. Someone offer some chocolate. So I think Dora's going to leave it at the back. So in case the meditation left a bitter taste in your mouth, then you can go and grab something sweet. And also some energy booster before Venerable comes to start the teaching. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, so before I continue, I wanted to check if there are any questions left from this morning that you wish to ask now before we go on. Anything that's urgent? We'll have a chance later for questions as well. Okay, so this morning I talked about bodhicitta and one method for developing bodhicitta. There's another method as well with 7 points, but that's enough for now. And we say that bodhicitta is the wish to reach enlightenment, Buddhahood, so that we can help all living beings. That's quite a big job to take on, and it may seem overwhelming and maybe even impossible. But it's, you know, we can start little by little. And one of my teachers, Lama Yeshe, one time was giving a talk in London, and he spoke about bodhicitta just in a very kind of practical way. He said, bodhicitta, you know, it's just when you're with another person and you just really open up and care about that person, that's bodhicitta. So I was really happy to hear that, because that sounds more doable than, you know, this big job of going all the way to Buddhahood. Of course, I mean, he didn't mean that's all there is to bodhicitta, but I think he was just emphasizing the practical side of it, you know, that's a place where we can start. We can start by just trying to be more open to others, more attentive to others, and, you know, understand that's another person like me, another being like me. They have a mind, a heart, feelings. They want to be happy. They don't want to suffer. And, you know, just really trying to be caring and helpful as much as possible. And also, one thing that Dalai Lama says, he says, try to help others as much as you can. And if you can't help them, at least don't harm them. So that's a good sort of bottom line, you know, something to keep in mind in our life. Trying to help others as much as I can, and, you know, at least trying to not harm them. And I always say try, because, you know, we're just ordinary beings. We're not already Buddhas. And so naturally we have our, you know, our self-centeredness and our anger and our greed and so on. So we have these states of mind. We can't help it. We can't just immediately stop having them. But at least, you know, if we try to be more caring towards others and try to avoid harming others, and if we make that a kind of bottom line for our life, you know, how to live our life, then, you know, at least we try. And if we make mistakes, well, we can learn from them and try to do better the next time. So if we really make a commitment to that, then I'm sure slowly, slowly we can change. Okay, so to move on, one aspect of mind training, Bojong, is about problems, how to transform problems into the path. So when it comes to problems, and problems here could mean any kind of problem. It could mean physical, having a tummy ache or a headache, or being sick, or hot, or tired, okay? So any kind of physical problem. But other kinds of problems would be more in the mental level, feeling unhappy, feeling bored, feeling restless, feeling hurt, anxious. So, or financial problems, relationship problems, so many different kinds of problems can happen in life. So normally, when problems happen, we probably don't feel very happy. We feel pretty, no, not this. I don't want this. Why does this have to happen to me? So there's this whole aspect of Lojong, mind training, about how we can actually use problems as part of our spiritual practice. So problems don't have to be obstacles or hindrances to our practice, but we can actually bring them in and make them part of our practice and learn from them. So I'm going to spend a bit of time talking about this, why we do it, and so on. So there's this quotation from Lama Tsongkhapa, he's the founder of our tradition, the Gelugpa tradition, and an author of many wonderful texts. So in one of his texts, the Lamrim Chenmo, Great Stages of the Path to Enlightenment, he said this. This is a paraphrase, but he basically said, you know, it's really important to learn how to use problems in the path, because otherwise, if we don't know how to do that, then it's sort of dangerous. One danger he pointed out is that we can develop hostility, we can get angry. And there's all different levels of anger, starting from mild irritation or impatience, all the way up to violent rage, where you're ready to kill somebody or do something destructive. Okay, so there's a whole range of different kinds of anger or hostility. But, you know, when a problem happens, it's easy to get angry, easy to get upset, irritated, unhappy. Okay, and that's dangerous, because that's a very dangerous state of mind. We might find ourselves acting out our anger, hurting others physically, verbally, and so on and so forth. So, and it's just a very disturbing state of mind as well. It's impossible to be happy and peaceful at the same time as feeling angry and hateful. I don't know if you've noticed that, but they're kind of opposite states of mind. So it destroys our own happiness and peace of mind, and it can also harm others. So hostility is a dangerous state of mind. And the other thing he says that could happen is we could get discouraged about following the path. Actually, I don't have to look. So this is another danger. If we face problems, if problems happen while we are in the course of following the path, practicing Dharma, practicing meditation, and so on. So it's possible that one might think, oh, this is too hard, practicing Dharma is too hard, meditating is too hard, and then want to give it up. Another thing that happens sometimes, we have to be careful about this, I think people sometimes have the expectation that if they start doing Dharma practice, practicing meditation, trying to be a good person, trying to create good karma, avoid bad karma, and so on, they may have the expectation that now everything should go well for me. I shouldn't have any more problems. Did you ever notice that? Yeah? We may not deliberately have this idea. It might just be a sort of underlying expectation that we might think, I'm being a good person. I'm doing good things. So everybody should be nice to me. Everything should go well for me. I shouldn't get sick. I shouldn't lose my job. I shouldn't have any kind of problems. I should get lots of money, and everything will go well for me from now on. Everything will be smooth and easy. Is that realistic? Well, of course, we wish that would be the case. But according to the Buddhist teachings, no, it's not realistic. One explanation for that is, according to Buddhism, this isn't the only life we've had. We've had many lives before this one. Many, many. Uncountable lives. And in all of those past lives, we've created all kinds of karma. Some good karma, but also some bad karma. So we come into this life with a whole baggage of karma, good and bad. And just because we start practicing meditation, start practicing Dharma, start following the path, doesn't mean all our bad karma is suddenly going to go away. It doesn't work like that. It's still there. Of course, part of our practice, especially in the Tibetan tradition, is purification. We do purification practice, like Vajrasattva and so forth. And that's meant to purify, clear away, get rid of bad karma. But still, that's something that takes a long time. We can't do it just in a short time. So we still have a lot of karma from the past. And it's only natural that, you know, in our life, some of this bad karma will ripen and we'll have problems. We'll have bad experiences. So it doesn't mean we're doing something wrong. This may be another thing that people think, you know. Oh, what am I doing wrong? This problem is happening to me. What have I done? I made a mistake. I did something wrong. According to Buddhism, you know, even if you're following the path, even if you're practicing really, really, really hard, you can still experience problems like sickness or, you know, people mistreating you. There's all these stories, for example, in Tibet of, you know, practitioners, yogis, meditators who are practicing really, 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 really hard, but they face problems. They get sick, they get, you know, attacked by bandits and beaten up and robbed and... Yeah, I mean, and just look what happened in 1950 when Communist China took over Tibet. And so many great lamas were put into prison, executed, tortured, beaten, starved to death. Horrible, horrible, horrible things happened to them. And, you know, I'm sure that was very hard for many of them, but many of them said, well, this is the ripening of our karma. This is happening to us because of our karma. Yeah. So they know that just because you're practicing Dharma doesn't mean everything is going to go well and you're never going to face any problems. So it's only natural that that would happen. But like Lama Tsongkhapa says, it's possible that if we're not careful, when problems happen in our life, we might want to give up Dharma. We might want to give up practicing. We may think, "Oh, this isn't working," you know, and then give it up, which would be a bit like throwing away the medicine. You know, if you're sick, you're really, really sick, and your doctor gives you some very precious medicine that will enable you to be cured. But maybe the medicine has some side effects that are unpleasant. So if you say, "Oh, I don't like this medicine," and then you throw it away, then that's really sad. Okay, it's like that's the thing that's going to cure you, enable you to get well. Okay, so Lama Tsongkhapa points out these dangers, and he says, therefore, it's very important for us to learn how to bring problems into the path. And now I'm having a problem with my computer. You know that little whirly thing that goes around, that rainbow thing that goes around and around and around? Well, that was just... Maybe it's okay now. No? Huh? Sorry? No. It was doing just fine. And I don't know what happened. Now it's frozen. Anyway, I can keep talking. And I don't have a rainbow whirl going around in my head. So let's see. Yeah, it's still going around. Okay, so does anyone know how to work with Macs? Maybe you can... Oh, wait a minute, now the arrow is back. Let's see. Is it show? Okay, now it's working again. Let's try it again. Now the projector is not working. Oh, the little thing is going again. Anyway, you can see the slide. So, point number two. Okay, so the rest of the bullet points on here are some things that we can do when it comes to problems, suffering, difficulties, to avoid becoming discouraged and to avoid becoming hostile and angry and unhappy. Yeah. Okay. So the second point is that is to think that suffering is a natural part of samsara. Samsara is the term we use for this situation that we are in. As long as we're not enlightened, as long as we're not Buddhas, We haven't reached nirvana, so we're in an unenlightened situation. So, as the Buddha pointed out in the very first teaching that he gave, you know, he spoke about true suffering or the truth of suffering. So that means that it's just natural, it's just inevitable that we experience problems, difficulties. Try it again. So it's helpful just to have an attitude of acknowledgement, acceptance. There is suffering, there are problems, as long as I'm in this world, as long as I'm not enlightened. Suffering is inevitable. It's impossible to go through life and have everything go perfect, never face problems. So it's just natural that we face problems and difficulties. I don't know what's going on here. It's so funny, it was working fine before. So maybe I just forget it. Just talk. Okay, another point is that I'm not the only person in the world who has problems, who has difficulties. Other people do too. So that's important to keep in mind, because what happens sometimes when we have a problem, we may, not intentionally, but unintentionally, we tend to get absorbed in our own suffering. And we may even feel like everybody else is doing really well. I'm the only person in the world who has problems and difficulties. Nobody else does. Have you ever noticed that? Your mind is saying that? Well, it's not true. It's definitely not true. You're not the only person in the world who has problems. Other people have problems too. And if you do have this idea, you're the only one who has problems and other people are doing really well, that will actually exacerbate your suffering. That will make things worse for you. Because then on top of having this problem, you also feel alone, isolated, cut off from others, almost like you're on a little island all by yourself in a prison. Everybody else is out there, free, happy, enjoying themselves, having a great time, right? So then you feel worse. On top of your suffering, you also feel alone in your suffering, and that's not at all helpful for you. So it is helpful to remember that you're not alone. Other people have problems. In fact, everybody has problems, including the billionaires, the millionaires, you know, the celebrities, the people who live in big mansions, drive big cars, and so forth. They have problems too. Yeah? So everyone has problems. You're not alone. So that will help you feel better. It takes away the loneliness, the isolation. Okay, but you have to be careful. We don't want this to turn into a kind of gloating, ha ha ha, other people suffer too, you know, and be happy that others are suffering. That's not the point. So be careful not to do that. But just to realize you're not alone. And also, there are benefits to having problems. One of the benefits is it helps you to have more compassion for others. Compassion, again, means the, you know, wishing others to be free of suffering, understanding that others suffer and wishing them to be free of suffering. And so to be able to understand that others suffer, it's helpful to know what suffering is. You know, if there's a person who had a really easy life, they never got sick, they never had any physical problems or pain, they never had any financial problems or psychological problems. Every day of their life, every minute, every second went really well. They never had any problems. It would be quite hard for that person to understand the suffering of others. They wouldn't know what it's like to have suffering, to have problems. So unless they're kind of an exceptional person, you know, they might be sort of devoid of compassion and empathy. Whereas when you yourself go through suffering and problems and difficulties, you know what it's like firsthand. Then when you encounter another person who's going through some difficulty, you know what they're going through. You've got your experience of that. Does that make sense? So then you can have empathy, you can have compassion, and you're probably more able to help them. Because when people don't have empathy or compassion, then and they're with somebody who's unhappy, who's suffering, the things that they do, the things that they say may make the person feel worse. Right? Even if they try to help, maybe they're trying to be helpful, but because they don't really understand what you're going through, the things they do may make worse suffering rather than being helpful. On the other hand, if you go through your own experiences of suffering, you know what it's like, then you know what is helpful and what isn't helpful, so you're more likely to be able to really benefit the other person instead of making things worse. So therefore, having problems, having difficulties, isn't necessarily a bad thing. And in fact, there's this quotation from Shantideva, who I mentioned earlier. He's a great Indian master. And in his text, Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, he mentioned a list of benefits of problems. I'm going to try this again. I'm not giving up so easily. Let's see. He mentioned some benefits of... Benefits of problems. Now the machine is off. We're having lots of problems today. So Shantideva mentioned these benefits. So one of the benefits is being able to have more compassion, increased compassion. Another benefit he mentioned is to have less arrogance or pride. Okay, so we'll talk about that later. It comes up in one of the eight verses, the problems of pride. Arrogance. So this is actually a kind of not working. Anyway, arrogance is a delusion, a negative state of mind that interferes with our practice, with our development of the spiritual path. So it's good not to have too much arrogance. Good to have humility, the opposite of arrogance. So I'm not exactly sure why he says problems, going through problems, coming back, can decrease our arrogance. But I have an idea. I think it may be because, you know, when we're not facing any problems or difficulties and things are going well, they're probably times in our life when things are smooth and easy and we feel as if we're on top of the world. And not facing many problems. So at those times in our life, it's quite possible that our mind, we can get kind of inflated, a sense of being inflated and, wow, I'm so great, I'm so fantastic. Full of ourselves, we say in English. That's arrogance. And then when you're arrogant, one of the main problems with arrogance is you tend to look down on other people. So people who aren't as good as you, not doing as well as you, not as beautiful as you, not as smart, as clever, as rich, and so forth, then you tend to look down on them with condescension. I am better. I am superior. They are down there. So it's kind of a very ugly state of mind. So that's a danger that can happen when we don't face problems or difficulties and things are going well. So then when problems do happen, it's a bit like pricking a balloon. You know, when we're arrogant, it's like you know, like being a blown up balloon, inflated. And when a problem happens, like all the air goes out of that balloon, becomes deflated. So our sense of being so wonderful, so fantastic, superior, looking down on others, whew, goes down. Of course, we have to be careful about that. It's not that we want to become depressed and sink into despair and so forth, but it just helps to deflate this overblown sense of I and self-importance and arrogance. It helps us to be more humble, more down to earth. And another benefit he mentions is never mind. Now you can look at this nice mountain. It helps us to be disillusioned with samsara. And that means samsara, again, is this situation in which we are not enlightened. We have all kinds of problems and difficulties and so on. Yeah, if you can figure out what's wrong. Yeah. Well, now it's just gone off. It shut itself. Okay, if you can try to restart it. Thank you. So this morning I was talking about this attitude we need to develop of renunciation, or the determination to be free, which means we recognize that we are in a situation which is imperfect and unenlightened. And we need to be disillusioned with this situation so that we wish to get out of it. We strive to get out of it and get to a higher state, such as nirvana or enlightenment. So if we kind of settle down and feel comfortable in samsara, in cyclic existence, in unenlightened existence, then we won't strive to get ourselves out, right? We'll just be stuck here. And that's not helpful, because, you know, Buddhism says we have been circling in samsara for countless lifetimes already, and we will continue to circle through these lifetimes in samsara until we get ourselves out. So we make the effort to free ourselves from this situation. And the way to free ourselves is mainly by developing the wisdom that sees the true nature of things, how things really are. But we need to want to do that. We need to have the strong desire or determination, will, to get ourselves out. And that determination comes from recognizing the imperfections, the disadvantages, the sufferings, the dukkha of cyclic existence. So when we can see this, that the situation we are in is so imperfect and so problematic, so unpleasant, then that motivates us to want to get ourselves out and then do the things we need to do to get ourselves out. So that state of mind of renunciation or determination depends on seeing problems. So when problems happen to us, we can remind ourselves, oh, well, this is samsara. This is how things are until I get out, until I reach nirvana. So in that way, we can use problems to further strengthen our determination to get ourselves out and then be able to get others out as well. Okay, so then another benefit Shantideva mentions. Let's try it again. Let's keep going forward. Just finding the right. No, I'm just. It's on. I'm just trying to find the right slide. Okay, yay, thank you. It's a little cut off on this side. Oh no. I think the computer doesn't like the projector. They don't seem to have a good relationship. Anyway, now you can see them. Okay, so the last two bullet points, these are sort of related. The second to the last one says to refrain from non-virtue, and the last one is to create virtue. So this has to do with karma and ethics, how we live, how we behave. So according to Buddhism, when we do face problems or difficulties, it's the result of karma that we created in the past. There's no God up there who decides, you're going to suffer and you're going to be a millionaire. You're going to have, you know, a wonderful life and you're going to be miserable. Okay? So it's not up to anyone else. It's not up to our parents or the government or other people. It's mainly our own karma, the karma that we created in the past and brought with us into this life. So that's the main factor that determines what kind of life we have, what kind of experiences we have. So that's basically what karma is all about. So not everyone believes in karma. You don't have to believe in karma if you don't want to, but it's part of the Buddha's teachings. And it's also there, I mean, even if they don't use the word karma, but you find a similar idea in all other religions as well. They all talk about the importance of doing good and avoiding bad. And the Bible says, you know, what you sow, you will reap. You reap what you sow, that kind of idea. So you sow certain seeds in the ground and you are going to get certain results in the end. Okay? So in Buddhism we call this karma. So if you can accept karma, then when problems happen, a Buddhist, a practitioner would think, well, this is happening to me because of karma that I created in the past. I mean, that's not the only factor. There are other factors as well. I mean, if somebody comes and robs you, you know, breaks into your house and steals your money and your jewels and so forth, well, I mean, that person is also a factor in this situation. And their delusions, their greed and so forth, and maybe the fact that you didn't have an alarm system, a security system is another factor. So there could be many different factors. But Buddhism would say, well, why did that happen to you? Why did your house get robbed and not somebody else's house? Okay. Why do you get sick and not somebody else? Right? So why do things happen to us and they don't happen to other people? Well, the main cause for that is the karma we created in the past. So a Buddhist would think, okay, I did harmful things in the past because problems, bad experiences are the result of non-virtue, non-virtuous karma. In the past, we hurt others, we killed, we stole, we lied and cheated. So we did harmful things to others in the past, and as a result of that, we are now experiencing problems, bad things happening. So a Buddhist would think, okay, well, you know, I can't put all the blame on other people. I created the karma for this to happen. And so then how you can turn this into something useful is to think, okay, now I know what it's like. What are the results of creating negative karma, bad karma, non-virtue? And I don't like this happening to me. So if I don't want this to happen again in the future, I have to stop creating that bad karma. I have to make sure I don't do that kind of thing anymore. If I don't like people breaking into my house and stealing my things, then I have to make sure I don't steal, I don't cheat, I don't, you know, do that kind of action myself. Okay? Because that's what brings this kind of result. Does that make sense? So then you can generate this very strong determination to refrain from non-virtue, creating non-virtue, bad karma. And the flip side of that is to create virtue. If I want good experiences to happen, I have to create the right causes. And that means virtue. Virtue is basically good karma, doing things that are helpful to others, pine, but also just refraining from non-virtue. You know, once we make the decision, I'm not going to kill, lie, steal, you know, do these harmful things, that itself is creating virtue. That itself is creating good karma. So this is a really big part of Buddha's teachings, refraining from non-virtue or bad karma, creating virtue or good karma, because basically we are the creators of our own experience. What kind of experiences we have in the future and even today are mainly determined by ourselves, our own actions, our thoughts, our words, our way of being. So if we can accept that, then it makes sense that we do the right things, we do virtuous, positive things, because that's what will bring good experiences. We refrain from non-virtuous or harmful things, because that's what brings bad experiences. So this is a really powerful way of thinking, because then when problems happen to us, if we think about it in this way, it can really turn our life in a positive direction. Say, from now on, I'm really going to try my best, my hardest, to create as much virtue as I can, refrain from non-virtue. So these are some... This is, as I say, pointed out by Shantideva, the great Indian master, and he said these are some benefits to problems. So having problems isn't necessarily a bad thing. It all depends on how we deal with them, how we look at them, what we do with them. So we can actually turn problems into something useful, something beneficial. Another thing that's helpful, I really like this, is impermanence. You know, just to remember that problems are impermanent. They don't last forever. Because again, what can happen sometimes is when a problem happens, some part of your mind might feel, oh, it's going to be here forever. It's never going to go away. I'm going to have this problem forever and ever and ever. Have you ever noticed that? It can seem like a permanent thing. If you feel depressed, you may think, oh, I'm going to be depressed forever. I'm never going to get out of this. Or if you're sick, oh, I'm going to be sick forever. I'm never going to get well. So there might be some little voice in your mind that says that. In other words, this is seeing the problem as permanent rather than impermanent. And it's simply not true. Problems are impermanent. Everything is impermanent. Nothing lasts forever. Things are changing all the time. So I find it really helpful to remind myself of that. When a problem happens, you know, okay, it's here now, but it's not going to be there forever. It's going to change. It's going to end one day. So it just helps you to be more relaxed instead of frantic, upset, freaked out. Does that make sense? And you can do this with problems that include like sickness or other kinds of problems. You can also do it with emotional problems that come up. Feeling unhappy, feeling depressed, feeling restless, bored, irritated. Whatever kind of emotional difficulty comes up in your mind. Some unpleasant state of mind that arises. We do this in meditation. We try to understand that whatever comes up in our mind, whatever thought, memory, emotion, feeling, experience, physical experience, mental experience, that these are impermanent, meaning they arise, they are there for a moment or two, and then they pass. And this is something you can experience for yourself. If you practice meditation, especially mindfulness meditation, you're watching your mind moment by moment by moment, then you can see for yourself how everything is momentary, everything is transitory. All of our experiences come and go. They don't last. So the more you can become familiar with and accepting of the impermanent nature of things, it really helps your life, your mind, your experience to be much more light rather than heavy. As you understand, all of these things are impermanent. not there forever. Okay, so let's see if I can change the slide. Okay, so I just wanted to mention a couple of resources or books for more information on this topic. So the first one is called Transforming Problems into Happiness. Probably, I'm sure many of you have read that book. It's been around for quite a few years. The author is Lama Zopa Rinpoche, the spiritual teacher, spiritual director of our center here. So that's all about this topic of how to bring problems into the path and transform them into happiness. The second book on the list is more recent. It was only published a couple of years ago. It's called No Mud, No Lotus, The Art of Transforming Suffering by Thich Nhat Hanh. Has anyone seen that book? It's really nice, very just small, very easy to read. And the whole idea, the title, No Mud, No Lotus, because in Buddhism, the lotus is used as a symbol for enlightenment, because a lotus always grows in a muddy place. It doesn't grow in nice, clean water, but it needs mud, which is kind of dirty and yucky. So the root of the lotus is in this dirty, muddy water, and then the stem comes up, and then the lotus flower opens above the water, and it's totally pure, you know, no mud on it, completely unstained by mud. So in a similar way, an enlightened being like the Buddha always comes about in the world, you know, like the Buddha was living in this world, lived in this world and practiced in this world, but was able to rise up above the sort of mud, the muddiness of the world, and reach this very pure state of enlightenment. And so the idea of no mud, no lotus is if we don't have the mud, we won't be able to have the enlightenment. And the mud here is suffering. Yeah? I mean, the Buddha went through a lot of difficulties, a lot of suffering to reach enlightenment. He didn't have an easy time of it. He lived out in the forest and didn't even have a roof over his head to protect him from the rain, or, you know, walls around him to protect him from insects and wild animals and so on. He just lived out there in the open and ate almost nothing and just practiced really, really, really hard. Went through all kinds of difficulties to reach enlightenment. So the idea is, you can't expect to reach enlightenment. You can't expect your mind to reach that amazing state of enlightenment without going through difficulties. It's inevitable that we go through difficulties. But we can use those difficulties. They can be part of our practice, part of our path that actually helps us get to enlightenment more quickly. So that's the idea. And then the last reference here is the Salata Sutra. I hope I spelled it right. So this is a sutra of the Buddha. You can find it online. Just type in Salata Sutra. This is the one where he spoke about the arrows. You may have heard this analogy. When we have suffering, a problem, it's like being struck with an arrow. And then depending on how we react, how we respond, we can make it into something worse or something better. If we get upset, angry, fret, moan, complain, blame, and all those kind of things, this is like shooting ourselves with a second arrow, which just makes things worse rather than better. So instead, if we can accept and use wisdom in this situation then we can become free of suffering rather than making it worse. So that's the sutra where that analogy comes from. So you could look into that as well. Okay, so how are we doing for time? Okay, so this is just talking about this topic of transforming suffering, transforming problems. And I'm going to start now talking about the eight verses, this text. If we can get that slide up. But are there any questions? Anyone have a question? Yay! Anything about what I've said so far? Yeah. This is a really good question. I think it's very good that you brought this up. What I was talking about was talking to ourselves. When we ourselves have some problem or difficulty, and if you believe in karma, if you accept karma, then you can bring in that idea and talk to yourself and say, well, you know, in a past life, I must have done something to, you know, to bring this about. So maybe I did the same kind of action that's now being done to me. Now this may be hard to accept, especially, you know, something really awful, somebody's abusing you, you know, you may think, oh, I would never do such a thing. But anyway, if you do think about it and you come to the conclusion, well, yes, I probably did. Because sometimes even we don't even have to think about past lives. You know, we don't have to imagine a past life in which we did something. Even in this very lifetime, we can sometimes remember things that we have done that are similar to what's being done to us. Yeah? So if you can recognize that, oh, I have also been hurtful. It doesn't mean you did the exact same thing that's being done to you, but maybe something similar. So if you were hurtful, if you were abusive, if you were inconsiderate, rude, and so on, deceitful or whatever, you can remember that in this very same lifetime, I did similar kind of behavior. Then that can help you to be more accepting of your own karma. But then when it comes to other people and another person's problem, I think you need to be very, very careful, very sensitive. Because, yeah, it can really hurt their feelings. It can make them more miserable. For example, I don't know if you heard about this woman. She wrote a book about her experiences. She's originally from Sri Lanka. And remember the tsunami that happened? How many years ago was that? Anyway, quite a few years ago. So she had married an Englishman and they'd been living in England, but they went back to Sri Lanka for a holiday, and she, her husband, her two sons, and her parents were all staying together in a hotel right near the sea when the tsunami happened. So this huge wave came and everybody was swept away. She was the only person who survived of her family. So she lost her husband, she lost her two sons, she lost her parents all at once. And then she almost lost her mind. So the grief, the suffering she had as a result of that, we can only imagine how terrible that was. She was suicidal, she was drinking a lot. She finally found help. She tried different therapists, psychologists. She finally found one psychologist who helped her to recover from this trauma, this suffering. And he encouraged her to write everything down, to write down all her memories, all her experiences. So she did that. She would spend hours just writing everything, not just about the trauma, but about her life with her family and her children and so forth. So she wrote it all down, and that was very therapeutic. Then he encouraged her to make it into a book. So the book, the name of the book is Wave, I think, just Wave. Has anyone read it? It's very, very good, very powerful. But anyway, I read an interview with her when the book was first published, and she said, you know, lots of people were trying to help her when, you know, after losing all her family members, and people would try different things, but some of the things people said and tried were actually not helpful at all. And I guess one of the things was somebody tried to talk to her about karma. That was definitely not helpful. I mean, you think about it, okay? If she were to think, oh, what happened to me was my karma, that means she is to blame for the loss of her children, her husband, her parents. It's her karma that all these people died. Okay? So, I mean, she's probably already blaming herself. She's probably already thinking, why did I have to go to that hotel? Why didn't I leave early? You know? This is natural, what people do when some kind of disaster like that happens. Why didn't I do something different? So she's probably already full of self-blame. So then to think, it's my karma, I mean, that would certainly send her to suicide, right? So that's not skillful. So we have to be very, very careful when we talk to other people and try to avoid saying things. I mean, I think it really does depend on the other person. It depends on your relationship. I'm not saying we should never, ever, ever talk about karma, but just do it in a very, very sensitive way, not in a way that would make them feel worse, that would make them more depressed or get into self-blame and so on and so forth. So I think the person's mind needs to be very strong, you know, before they would be able to think in terms of karma. And also, it also depends if they accept karma. If the person doesn't accept karma, doesn't believe in karma, it wouldn't be right to try to push them to think that way. Does that make sense? So I'm not saying you should never talk about karma, but you just have to be very careful, very, very careful when talking about this with another person. It's primarily for oneself, you know, to help one's own mind be more accepting. Does that make sense? Now, some of you may disagree with me, but that's just my opinion. What happened to verse 1? Okay, there it is. Any other question? Yeah. Like, yeah. Well, you know.
I like certain problems.
Yeah.
Those things that I like. But there are other problems in life that I'm not sure I can ever, especially some certain form of suffering.
Yeah. Well, I was being kind of cheeky there. But, you know, in this book of Lama Zopa Rinpoche's, of, he says you can get to the point where you like problems like ice cream. Like, you know, normally people are very happy to have the chance to eat ice cream, or you can replace that with whatever your other, you know, whatever other kind of food you like. You know, certain types of foods or drinks, when we have the chance to have that, we're very happy. We love it, right? But when it comes to problems, we feel, oh no, I don't want that. And he says, actually, bodhisattvas, those who are, you know, really dedicated to attaining enlightenment for the benefit of all beings, bodhisattvas actually do like problems. But they like problems more than happiness. They favor problems to happiness. And that sounds kind of weird, maybe perverted. But it's because they know that problems are rich, are beneficial, are useful. They can learn a lot, they can grow a lot. There's a lot of things you can do with problems that will help you progress along the path, get closer to enlightenment. Whereas when good things happen, you know, nice things happen to us, that's not necessarily beneficial for our spiritual practice, right? We feel good, we feel happy, but we could get attached, you know, we could have attachment coming up, we could have more ego, more pride, right? So there's the danger of more disturbing emotions, more afflictive emotions coming up in our mind when good things are happening. Yeah, but when problems happen, that's like really challenging. That's a real challenge. And then if you can rise to meet that challenge, work with that problem, then you have a chance of furthering your progress. So I'm certainly not at the point where I like problems. I don't enjoy, but I think if you were really, really, really dedicated to attaining enlightenment, developing yourself, transforming yourself, and reaching enlightenment, I could imagine that you could see the benefits of problems and be happy about problems. Yeah, I think that's the idea. And I was just thinking about something that I heard Achan Brahm. You may have heard of Achan Brahm, a Theravada teacher. He teaches a lot of meditation. And he was saying that, you know, when we're meditating, and sometimes we feel like we're having a good meditation, you know, we're able to sit still, and our mind is quiet and calm and peaceful. And then we may think, oh, this is great. This is a good meditation. I like this. I want it to be like this all the time. But then at other times, we may feel as if we're having a bad meditation. You know, we're restless. We can't sit still. We're fighting sleepiness. Our mind is crazy, going all over the place. We can't control it. And then we think, oh, this is a bad meditation. I don't like this. I don't want this to happen. So he said it's best not to judge your meditations and have a preference. I like this and I don't like that. This is good. This is bad. Because he said actually the so-called bad meditations may be the most beneficial for your progress. Because when you're having a hard time sitting still, keeping your mind still, you have to work harder. You have to put more effort into trying to keep yourself there and keep your mind on your object. So you have to make more effort, and you may learn more in those times. But when things are smooth and easy, then there's the danger of just kind of getting complacent, you know, relaxed and complacent and not working so hard. So I thought that's an interesting comment. And I definitely agree with him that it doesn't help at all to judge your meditations and say, this is a good one, this is a bad one, I like this, I don't like that. Because this is attachment and aversion. We have attachment to a so-called good meditation, we have aversion to a so-called bad one. So then our mind is swinging back and forth between those two states of mind, attachment, aversion, liking, disliking. So that's not helpful. So ideally, the best thing is to just accept whatever kind of meditation you're having, whatever kind of experience you're having, and see it all as just steps along the path. Try to make the best of it. Try to learn from it. Is that okay? Okay, so There's this text, it's called the Eight Verses. The full title is the Eight Verses of Thought Transformation or Mind Training, Lojong. So it's a Lojong text. There's actually a number of different Lojong texts. Some are longer, some are shorter. This is pr- probably the shortest one. It has only 8 verses. And it was written by a Tibetan named Longri Tangpa about 1,000 years ago. I don't have a whole lot of information about him, but there are some stories we'll maybe we can look at a bit later. anyway, this is a little text about mind training, so I thought we'd go through it, look at each verse. And there are different translations of these verses. So the translation that I'm using here is one that, actually, we used to use this in the old days, in the early days of Amitabha Buddha Center. When I first came, we were located on Butterfly Avenue. Maybe some of you went to, I know some of you did, went to Butterfly Avenue, a little bungalow on Butterfly Avenue. And every Sunday morning, we would do this practice. We would have this meditation, meditating on Chenrezig, Kuan Yin, like the statue we have behind us here. We didn't have that statue then, but we would visualize, we would imagine thousand-armed Chenrezig in front of us, and then part of the practice involved reading these 8 verses and meditating on them a little while, and then reciting Om Mani Padme Hum. Very nice practice. I love doing that practice. Beautiful. So at that time we had these little prayer books called Pearl of Wisdom prayer books. And so this version of the 8 verses was in that prayer book. And I memorized it. So I still have this in my memory. I can recite it from heart. So I'm using this one because I know it. But, you know, if you wanted to study it on your own or memorize it on your own, there are other versions of it, other translations of it. Okay, so this first verse, is talking about how sentient beings are precious. So it says, with the thought of attaining enlightenment for the welfare of all beings, who are more precious than a wish-fulfilling jewel, I will constantly practice holding them dear. So we have this expression, sentient beings. Sentient beings are beings who have mind. And it includes not just people, human beings, but lots of other beings as well, such as animals. And animals, it also includes birds, fish, insects, snakes, and so on, so all those kinds of beings. And then Buddhism also talks about other kinds of beings that we may not be able to see, like ghosts, hungry ghosts, and beings in hell. There's also hell, and that's full of sentient beings who have the worst kind of suffering. And then there's heaven. In fact, there's many heavens in Buddhism. I think about 27 altogether. The term for those is, sometimes they use the word God with a small g, but I prefer the word Deva. Deva is the Sanskrit term for those beings living in heaven. So they have a more comfortable, more pleasant life than we have. So Buddhism says there's many different kinds of sentient beings beyond just human beings. And so ideally, when we cultivate these positive qualities, such as love, compassion, altruism, we do so not just for a limited number of beings, but for all beings without leaving anybody out. Of course, that's very difficult to do. It takes a long time to work on. But it's worth it. It's worth being able to overcome feelings of aversion, dislike, disgust, or indifference, uncaring towards any living being, and instead be able to open up your heart and feel kindness and compassion and love for all beings, or at least as many as possible. And so gradually, by working on that, we are able to feel these positive feelings for more and more people and beings. And so again, this whole topic of mind training or Lojong is part of the Mahayana tradition, meaning it's part of the path for becoming enlightened, becoming a Buddha. And why do we want to become a Buddha? It's not for our own sake, not just so that I am free from suffering and I have the best experience possible, but it's for the benefit of others. So it should be, one should have that motivation, that attitude. I want to help others, and to be able to help others, the best way I can help others is by becoming enlightened. So that's what's mentioned in the first two lines, with the thought of attaining enlightenment for the welfare of all beings. And then the next line says, who are more precious than a wish-fulfilling jewel. So they talk about this in the Buddhist teachings. I don't know if there really is such a thing, but it's a bit like Aladdin's lamp, or I don't know, maybe you have something like that in Chinese mythology, some kind of object, and you can rub it, make prayers, make wishes, and whatever you wish for, bing, you know, you get it. Right? So that's the idea of a wish-fulfilling jewel. It can fulfill all your wishes. Maybe the modern-day equivalent would be a credit card. Take a credit card in any store and just, well, of course you have to have money in the bank, but you can buy anything you want. So it says that sentient beings are more precious than a wish-fulfilling jewel. So why is that? So it said that with a wish-fulfilling jewel or with a credit card, you can get material things. You can buy clothes and car and house, and so material things. And of course, with those material things, you can get a certain amount of pleasure and happiness. And of course, we need food to survive. So with our credit card, we can buy ourselves food, keep ourselves alive. So with a wish-fulfilling jewel or with a credit card, you can get material things that will bring you a certain amount of happiness and comfort and pleasure. However, there's different kinds of happiness. Okay, I came across this teaching that I thought was really helpful in a book called Being Nobody Going Nowhere by Aya Khema. I don't know if you've heard of her, Aya Khema. She's passed away now, but she was originally from Germany, and her family was Jewish. And she was born before the Second World War, so her family had to escape from Germany, to escape the Nazis, the Holocaust. And she had a really interesting life, you know. There's actually a story about her life which I recommend. It's fascinating. It's called I Give You My Life. She was all over the world. She had all kinds of adventures. And it was only in the later part of her life, I think she was in her 40s or 50s, that she actually met Buddhism and then started meditating, became a nun, became a teacher, and so on and so forth. But anyway, so this book was one of her first books, called Being Nobody Going Nowhere. And in that book, she, one section explained different kinds of happiness, four different kinds of happiness, she said, that were explained by the Buddha. So the first kind of happiness we could call sense, maybe it's better to call it pleasure, sense pleasure. So that's the kind of happiness we get with our senses when we eat delicious food, we smell nice odors like perfume, or we hear beautiful sounds like beautiful music or the singing of birds, so pleasant sounds. When we look at beautiful objects, you know, like works of art or flower gardens or other people's bodies, attractive bodies, and so on. So visual objects. And then with our body, when we have pleasant physical sensations, you know, like having a massage or going swimming or whatever. So we have five senses: seeing, hearing, smell, taste, and touch. So whenever we have some pleasant experience with any of our five senses, that's the first kind of happiness or pleasure, sense pleasure. Okay. And it is pleasant, those experiences are pleasant. But on the other hand, they're usually short term, they don't last so long, they only may last a few seconds or minutes or hours, but you know, sooner or later they're like when you eat a delicious meal. Once you finish eating, you know, that pleasure is over. And then a few hours later, you're hungry again, and you have to eat again, and so on and so forth. So it's kind of short-term, limited pleasure. Then there's a second kind of happiness. And I think she called it deva happiness. I would call it spiritual happiness. This is happiness that comes from developing our mind, developing positive qualities in our mind, like compassion, love, like we were talking about this morning. You know, when you have compassion, when you have kindness, altruism, caring about others, genuinely caring and helping others, then this brings another kind of happiness. It's more deep. It's more fulfilling, satisfying, and it could also be more long-term, might last longer. I think maybe, you know, when we practice meditation and if we're able to calm down our mind so it's not just wild, crazy, running all over the place, and we may experience a certain amount of peace, calmness, contentment in our mind, I think that would also be included in this second kind of happiness, or yeah, divine or spiritual happiness. And if you compare those two kinds of happiness, you probably feel that the second one is more satisfying, more meaningful. First kind can be kind of self-centered, egotistical, you know, when you have an ice cream cone, for example, you know, and you're eating it, enjoying it. This is so good. So, you know, it's like very much involved with me and my pleasure, and there can be a lot of attachment involved. And it can lead to craving, wanting more and more and better. And that's how addiction comes about, you know, getting addicted to that object, never having enough of it. So there's some dangers with that first type of pleasure. With the second one, there's probably less danger of getting caught up in the ego and getting attached, having attachment and craving. It might still happen, but still it's kind of, I think it's a more wholesome, more positive kind of happiness than the first one. And then there's a third kind of happiness, and that is the happiness that comes from concentration. So with the practice of meditation, if you train your mind to stay focused or concentrated on an object, the breath or an image of the Buddha or whatever, and you're able to stay in concentration longer and longer and longer, and eventually you can attain what's called shamatha, calm abiding. This is a state where you're able to stay in meditation for 4 hours or more without your mind being distracted or sleepy or, you know, having any kind of faults. It's like very pure, strong concentration. And it said that when you reach that state, you have incredible bliss, physical and mental bliss. That's much, much better than any of the other kinds of pleasant experiences we've ever had. So it's just like super bliss. So that's the third kind of happiness. This super bliss that comes from concentration. Okay, so that's even better than the previous one. Yeah, it's also more long-lasting because you can remain in that state for hours. And it said that, you know, when you have that kind of bliss, you don't get tired and you don't want to go and eat. You don't want to do anything else. You're happy to just stay there in meditation. Then there's a fourth kind of happiness, and that is the happiness that comes from developing wisdom. So wisdom is, well, there's different kinds of wisdom, but here it's the wisdom that understands reality, the true nature of things, the actual way things exist. And that is the antidote to our disturbing emotions, anger, greed, ignorance, and so forth. So, as I mentioned before, it is possible to free our minds from disturbing emotions, klesha, delusions, so that they just don't arise anymore. And the way to do that, what it is that eliminates the disturbing emotions, the delusions in our mind, is wisdom. So wisdom is like the weapon or the medicine, the antidote that wipes out the delusions. And the delusions are what disturb our mind, you know, make our mind disturbed and unpeaceful and unhappy. So once they've been wiped out, cleared away, eliminated from the mind, then the experience of happiness or bliss is even greater. It's really fantastic. I mean, I'm not talking from experience, but from this is what the Buddha says, this is what the yogis say. So there are these different levels of happiness that get progressively better, okay? And probably for most of us, most of our experiences are the first kind of happiness, the sensory one. You know, pleasant feelings in our body, pleasant sounds, tastes, smells, visual objects. And probably most people get very hung up, very attached to that kind of experience and keep running after it, wanting more and more and more and more and more and more. And it's not that it's wrong to have those experiences, but the problem is if we get attached, have attachment and clinging and craving and wanting more and more and more and more. So then we get stuck on that level. And if we want to have the higher forms of happiness, the second and third and fourth, we need to do some work on our mind. We need to work on concentration and work on cultivating kindness, compassion, and so forth. So that takes some effort in meditation. And when we do try to meditate, we probably find it difficult to concentrate, right? Not so easy to keep your mind concentrated. It keeps running away. Where does it go when it runs away? Much of the time, it goes to objects of our senses, sensory objects. We remember movies that we saw, music that we listened to, food that we ate, nice vacations that we went on. So all these memories of past pleasant experiences. Or we plan future ones, where we're going to go after the class today, what kind of food we're going to eat, what kind of movie we're going to watch, and so on and so forth. So, you know, we're anticipating, hoping for pleasant experiences in the future. Or we fantasize. That's another thing that the mind tends to do, is just create fantasies for pleasant experiences that we want. So my guess is, for most people, when our mind gets distracted, wanders away during meditation, most of the time it's because of attachment. Attachment to sensory pleasures, sensory experiences. So if you can see that, if you can understand that, then that shows why, you know, this first kind of happiness, attachment to the first kind of happiness is actually a hindrance, a problem to being able to progress in meditation and achieve the higher forms of happiness. So it's, you know, we shouldn't think the Buddha is trying to take away our happiness. The Buddha doesn't want us to enjoy ourselves. The Buddha wants us to have the best kind of happiness, the highest kind of happiness, the happiness that comes from concentration, wisdom, and so forth. And to achieve those higher kinds of happiness, we need to meditate. And when we meditate, we need to be able to train our mind and keep our mind focused on what we're meditating on. So why I'm talking about all of this is because in this verse, you know, it's saying that sentient beings are more precious than a wish-fulfilling jewel. So with a wish-fulfilling jewel, if there was such a thing, you know, we would be able to get material things, and that would enable us to have the first kind of happiness, but not the second kind of happiness. We can't get that from a wish-fulfilling jewel or credit card. Okay, we can't buy that kind of happiness. And we can't get the third and the fourth kinds of happiness. Okay. So to be able to achieve, to have those higher forms of happiness, we need to engage in the practice of meditation. And in the practice of meditation, one of the things we need to do, whether we want to achieve enlightenment, full enlightenment, Buddhahood, or achieve nirvana, we need to work on overcoming our anger and aversion towards sentient beings, and we need to cultivate loving kindness and compassion and positive attitudes towards sentient beings. So sentient beings, other sentient beings, are not a hindrance to our practice of the Dharma and practice of meditation and making progress on the path. They're not a hindrance. They're actually a necessity. We actually need them. We need them as objects towards whom we cultivate these positive qualities, kindness, compassion, patience, and so forth, so that then our mind will develop and be able to achieve these higher states of mind, higher forms of happiness. I don't know if what I'm saying makes any sense to you. Does it make sense? It's a little bit roundabout way of saying it. But anyway, sentient beings are precious. They're very, very precious. I'll relate to a story. When I was studying in Italy a number of years ago in the master's program, one of my teachers, Kenser Jambatekchok, we probably haven't met him, but there's a number of books of his teachings available. And one day in class, he threw out this question to us. He said, "Why is it that the Buddha has compassion for all sentient beings? Why does the Buddha have compassion and wish to help all sentient beings?" And it seemed like a kind of simple question, you know, not as complicated as emptiness or something, but people were giving different answers. And he wasn't satisfied with any of the answers that anybody gave. And we went on like this for, I don't know, half an hour, 40 minutes. And nobody gave him the answer he was looking for. So finally he said, "The reason that the Buddha has compassion for all sentient beings and wants to help all sentient beings is because the Buddha knows all the kindness he has received from sentient beings." See, a Buddha has total recall, remembering all the past lives he's ever lived, from whenever, beginning, no beginning. So Buddha can remember all his past lives and is able to see all the connections, all the relations he has had with every person, every being. And you probably heard this. They talk about this a lot in Tibetan Buddhism, that every being has been our mother. Every being has been our mother, has been our father, our brother, our sister, our friend, our child. So we've had every possible kind of relationship with everybody. But they particularly focus on the mother, because they say that's the relationship that, where we receive the greatest kindness. Mother gives so much to her child, her baby. So we can't remember our past lives, but a Buddha can. So the Buddha can remember all his past lives, all the relationships he's ever had, and he can see directly that every single sentient being has been his mother, has given birth and taken care of and sacrificed herself for him. And that's just one example, but there's so many other examples. Every being has also provided us with food, and been our doctor, cured us of sickness, been our friend, been our teacher, okay? So we have actually received a huge amount of kindness, care, and help from every single sentient being. So every single being has been helpful to us. So I thought that was a very profound teaching, you know, and trying to imagine, you know, how a Buddha would be able to, you know, see what all other beings have done for him, the kindness that they have done for him. And my teacher said, that is why Buddha feels compassion. It's repaying the kindness. Okay? When someone is kind to us and helpful to us, naturally, we feel grateful, we feel appreciative, thankful, and we will help that person when they are in need. So that's how the Buddha looks at us. We've been his mother, we've been his father, we've been his friend, his doctor, his teacher, you know. And so the Buddha remembers that directly. And so he wants to repay our kindness. He wants to help us now. So that's actually one way that we can understand this line about how all sentient beings are precious, more precious than a wish-fulfilling jewel. Because just like the Buddha, we have also received a huge amount of kindness from every sentient being. They have been our mother, they have been our father, and even if it's, you may find it hard to think about past lives and that kind of, you know, relationship, but even in this lifetime, just thinking about this lifetime, everything we have comes to us from others. This very body that we have, without this body, we wouldn't be alive. We wouldn't be here. So where does our body come from? The only way for a human body to come into existence is inside the womb of a woman, a mother. They can't produce babies in factories or laboratories, okay? So we come into this world through our mother. We had a mother, she gave birth to us and then took care of us. And our father also probably took care of us and helped us and taught us. And then other family members and so on and so forth. And then our teachers in school teaching us whatever we know so that we can, you know, graduate, get a job, make a living and so on and so forth. So everything we have, everything we use, everything we enjoy comes to us from others. Other beings. Okay, so that's another way we can think about how others are precious. Does that make sense? Yeah. Well, maybe we could do some meditation on this. I've been talking quite a lot. So before we do the meditation, if you want to stand up, stretch, wake yourself up.
Thank you. Thank you. Because I have a lot of things to do at home.
Okay.
No problem. Then tomorrow we have revision class. So I have to miss it.
Okay, so let's get started the meditation. So for the first few minutes, just sit quietly. Relax your body and pay attention to your breathing flowing in and flowing out. And in this way, let your mind settle down and be right here, right now. Present moment, present place. If other thoughts come into your mind, understand that they are transitory, like clouds in the sky. Clouds are not permanent parts of the sky, but they appear and they're there for a few moments, then they disappear. So in a similar way, our mind is like the sky, and thoughts, memories, feelings, perceptions, all these different experiences are like clouds passing through the sky. They arise in our mind, they last a short moment, then they pass away. So try to just notice them, be aware of them, but not get caught up in them and follow them. And instead let them go and return to the breath. Bring your awareness back to your breathing. Now expand your awareness from your breathing to the whole of your body. Just become aware of your body sitting on your cushion or your chair. So the body we have now is fully grown, fully developed, strong, healthy, able to do a lot of things. We're able to take care of ourselves, go here and there, and work, travel, and do different kinds of activities, sports, and so on. And we might sometimes just take this for granted and not really think about where our body came from and how it came to be the way it is now. But going back into the past, however many years you've been alive, if we go back that many years to the very beginning of our life, at that point in time, this body was very small and also very helpless. So in other words, once we were a tiny baby, an infant, and we were unable to do the things we can do now, totally dependent on others for food, for bathing, changing of clothes, moving from one place to another. So we probably don't remember that time of our life, but we can imagine, because we've all seen little babies, we know what they look like. So try to imagine yourself at that time in your life when you were a tiny, a helpless little child. And even before that, our life started off as a microscopic zygote, fertilized egg inside of our mother's womb. Combination of the egg from our mother, the sperm from our father. So tiny, can't even be seen with the eye. So that was the very start of our body and our life. So we wouldn't be here if it weren't for our parents, our biological parents, who provided those substances from which our present body developed. And then we grew inside of our mother's womb, and during that time she probably took a lot of care to make sure she ate the right foods and did the right activities and avoided activities that would be harmful to us. But she really was careful to make sure that we developed properly within her. And then after 9 or so months, we were born, a time that was probably quite difficult for our mother. Usually there's a lot of pain in giving birth, sometimes going on for hours. So just the fact that our mother was willing to carry us in her womb and give birth to us is a huge act of kindness. It means we are able to have this body and this life that we now have and able to do so many enjoyable things. So then after we were born, again, we were very helpless. We couldn't take care of ourselves, couldn't do anything for ourselves, so we needed to be fed, we needed to be changed, our diapers, our clothing, bathed, carried here and there, given a lot of attention, kindness, protection. So think about the people who did take care of you at that time, parents, grandparents, older siblings, aunts, uncles. Get a sense of how kind they were in giving you that care that you needed at that time in your life. Our parents are also our first teachers, teaching us really basic things like how to talk, how to use our body to crawl and then walk, how to drink from a cup, eat from a spoon or chopsticks, put on clothes, shoes, and so forth. So our parents and other people spend a lot of time and they have a lot of patience teaching us, guiding us, so that we could learn these basic skills when we were small. And then later, when we were older, we started going to school. So again, we depended on teachers teaching us how to read letters, how to sing songs, play musical instruments, draw, how to work with numbers, and so on. So all the knowledge we have now, it makes it easy for us to live in this world and get jobs and so forth and relate with other people, came to us because of our teachers teaching us, and also the people writing textbooks, producing other educational materials. So again, we're dependent on a lot of people to have the knowledge that we have. We are also dependent on other people for the things we use and need for our survival. For example, food. We need to eat food. We eat food several times a day. And that food comes about from other people. Much of it is grown by farmers, growing grains and vegetables and fruits. Dairy farmers, if we use milk products, milk, cheese, butter. If you eat meat, that comes from animals, chickens, cows, and so on. So most of those people and beings, we never meet, but we benefit from the work that they do, the goods they provide us with. So in that sense, we depend on their kindness. The same is true for everything else in our life, the clothes that we wear, shoes, the books that we read, the computers, phones, iPads we use, the buildings we live in and work in and play in, the cars we drive in, buses, trains, roads. So all of these things are made by others. There are people who work to produce these things and make them available for us. And then, if you're interested in the spiritual path, if you want to learn meditation and follow a spiritual path and achieve higher states of mind, such as shamatha and wisdom and nirvana and enlightenment, so to be able to attain those states, those goals, we are also dependent on others. Because to reach those goals, we need to cultivate certain qualities like compassion and love and joy and equanimity, the four Brahmaviharas or immeasurable states. We also need patience and ethics, meaning not harming others, refraining from harm, helping others instead. And to be able to practice all those and cultivate those, we need others. If we were all alone on a planet, no one else around, just oneself, how would one be able to cultivate those states of mind? And thus be able to progress along the path. So that is why it is said in this first verse that sentient beings are precious, even more precious than a wish-fulfilling jewel. They are precious because they provide us with everything in our life that makes our life rich and enjoyable and meaningful. But they are also precious in terms of spiritual practice. Because having other sentient beings there as objects of our cultivation of positive qualities means that we are able to cultivate those qualities and in that way progress along the path and eventually reach enlightenment. So see if you can get a sense of that, of how others are precious and therefore it is important for us to hold them as dear, regard them as dear, precious, and important. We've got time for one or two questions, if anyone has something you'd like to ask. Want to use the microphone? Okay, I can repeat it for
Yeah, in the earlier session, we mentioned the practice of Tonglen. Definitely, is positive. Is good, but I think we also have to be careful when we do that practice. Right, the timing, depending on our state of mind. If we are not prepared, it could have some repercussion. What is your comment?
Well, actually, yeah, it is an advanced practice. And in fact, one of the verses, I think it's verse number 7 in the 8 verses, it talks about secrecy. Because originally this practice wasn't taught publicly. It was just taught to, you know, students that a teacher would consider ready to do the kind of practice. But then sometime later, this was going back like 1,000 years in Tibet, this one lama was teaching this practice to people who suffered from lepers, I think they call it. And they did this practice, and they started getting better. They were getting cured of their leprosy. And then he thought, wow, this is such a powerful practice, and he wanted to make it more widely available. So he wrote a text in which he explained this practice. So it is, I suppose, yeah, it could be tricky if you didn't do it well, or you didn't do it right, or you did it, yeah, in a certain way. It might bring problems. But they do say in the teachings that, you know, in the beginning, some people may feel frightened of the whole idea of taking on others' suffering. And that's quite normal. That's quite understandable. So they say it might be best to start with your own suffering, taking on your own suffering. So there is actually a way of doing Tonglen where instead of thinking of somebody else's suffering and taking that on, you think about your own suffering. And I find actually this is a great practice to do. I didn't talk about it, but I'll just briefly explain it. Maybe we can do it tomorrow. Let's say you have a problem. Let's say a headache. Okay, you got a headache, which is unpleasant. And but you could use that experience to practice Tonglen. So you could think, the way you do it is this. You think, okay, I have a headache, it's painful, but I'm not the only person in the world who has a headache. Other people have headaches too. And some people may even have worse headaches than mine, right? Some people have like super migraine, you know, they have to be in a dark room with, you know, lying in bed and doing nothing for days. They have such terrible headaches. So maybe your headache isn't that bad. So then you can think, wow, you know, it's bad, but it could be worse. And that itself can help to kind of relieve your tension. But then you can think, okay, other people have headaches too. And now because I have a headache, I know what it's like. So I know how those people are suffering. And I really wish they could be free of their suffering. So you generate compassion. How wonderful if all the other people could be free of their headaches. Then you say to yourself, okay, I will accept this suffering. I will go through this suffering. I will bear this suffering. And by doing that, I wish all those other people could be free of their headaches. May their headaches go away. So you're not actually taking on more suffering than you already have. But you're transforming your attitude about your suffering so that instead of thinking, oh, poor me, isn't this terrible, and, you know, all this kind of thought, you're thinking, oh, by me experiencing this, may everyone else be free of their suffering. But you can still take a Panadol, you know. It doesn't mean... it doesn't mean you cannot take medicine or, you know, find a solution to your problem. You can still do that. But it may not go away immediately. So while it's still there, you're still going through it, then you can think this way in your mind, do this practice in your mind. And it's a way of doing Tonglen and kind of getting you more ready to do the full Tonglen, where you can take on others' suffering. And it's also a very practical method. I find when I do it, it really gives some relief. You know, even if the headache doesn't go away, but your mind is more calm, more accepting of it, instead of freaking out, you know. And does that make sense? So that's a good kind of practice to do in the beginning, you know, if you feel a little apprehensive about doing the full form of Tonglen and taking on other suffering. But I sometimes meet people, even they're not even Buddhist, but they hear about Tonglen and they may even, you know, do the Tonglen practice in a group, and they think it's wonderful and fantastic. They love doing it. So, yeah. So everyone is different. So you shouldn't, like, push yourself or feel obliged to do it. So it should be done, you know, within feeling good about it and comfortable about it. So if you do feel a little apprehensive, then you shouldn't push yourself to do it. And also you could try this more simple way.
Questions about Tonglen. As I understand, Tonglen is a mental practice. It's not about real help to people, right?
It's not about what?
A real help to people.
Real help? Yeah, so you're
just
doing it in your mind.
Thinking.
Yeah.
Is it right?
Yeah. It is something you do just completely within yourself, and nobody else needs to know that you're doing it. I mean, it doesn't mean that this is all we should do. I mean, of course, if somebody has had a heart attack and they're lying there, you know, you don't just sit there and do Tonglen. You offer whatever help you can. If you know how to help them yourself, or you call the ambulance to come and help them. So, of course, if there's some practical help that you can give, then you do that. But, you know, there are times when maybe there isn't anything we can do practically. For example, if somebody's depressed, you know, and maybe we've tried to talk to them, we've tried to listen to them, but maybe they're not open, or what we say doesn't work, so they're still depressed. So in that case, you could do this practice of Tonglen, and, you know, imagine taking their suffering, giving them happiness. Okay, so it's not meant to replace real help, if you can give real help and if that's needed. But it's just on top of real help. It's an additional thing. Does that make sense?
So if you know how to help people, it's better to help really than thinking about how to help.
Yeah. No. If you can, if there is a person who needs help and you know how to help them, you can help them. Of course you should do that. But, you know, people on the other side of the world, people in Yemen right now, you know, we may not be able to give them real help. We can donate money to provide food for them. But, you know, there's a lot of people in the world who need help, but our ability to actually help them in a real way, in a physical way, is quite limited. So this is at least something we can do on a mental level. But, you know, the real purpose of doing Tonglen practice isn't so much to help others, but it's to help ourselves. Because we need to transform our attitude. We need to become less self-centered and more altruistic. So that's the primary goal or benefit of this practice, is transforming our own mind. Whether it helps others or not is not definite. In fact, it said most of the time it doesn't help others. Really, because we cannot. They said if it was possible to take away somebody's suffering and give them happiness, the Buddha would have done that already for all of us. Yeah, the Buddha would have taken away all our suffering and given us all the happiness and good karma and everything else. It's just not possible, because each person, each one of us, is responsible for our own karma, our own experiences. Nobody can create karma for us. Nobody can make us happy. Nobody can take away our suffering. Only we can do that. So we can't really do that for others. But if we do this practice, it's powerful for transforming our own mind, helping us to have more love and compassion, get close to enlightenment. And then we're able to help others more.
Thank you.
So we'll stop here for today. And thank you so much for coming. We'll carry on tomorrow. And let's finish by dedicating the positive energy, the merit that has been created here today, coming together, making the effort to come here, listen, stay awake, think about and meditate on these teachings. This has been a good thing to do. So try to feel that way. Try to feel confident that we've done a good thing here today, created good energy, merit. And the best thing we can do with this merit is share it with others. So just as at the beginning today we thought about others and wanted to help others, so let's remember that. And now share this positive energy with others, with all sentient beings, wishing that it will bring happiness, peace, well-being, freedom from suffering and the causes of suffering, and help everyone get closer to enlightenment. Okay, so have a good evening and see you tomorrow.
No need to just leave the seats as it is for tomorrow's session. Yeah.
I was supposed to say that and I forgot.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, just leave your cushions for tomorrow.